I had my children on the floor. I was on my favourite blanket that my grandmother gave me on the floor like a cat.
And I realised in that moment the potential of what our bodies can really do as women.
Like, I could feel his head. I could do my own internal, like, yeah, his head, I could feel it.
I was in tears. I was just in tears and overwhelmed with gratitude.
Hi, and welcome to the Natural Birth Podcast, the podcast that is bringing embodied birth wisdom from women from all over the world sharing their natural birth stories. Don't forget to subscribe and download so that you can always have access to these empowering and positive natural birth stories.
Hi, my name is Anna, and I am the Natural Birth Podcast host. I'm a former midwife turned midwitch, and I now work with women worldwide, assisting them in having an empowering and natural birth experience and to truly claim their birth as a rite of passage. I offer one-on-one sessions and packages and online courses for conscious mamas who don't want to leave their birth up to chance. I also mentor current and aspiring birth workers in my Sacred Birth Worker Mentorship Program. If you want to know more about me and what I do in the world, then please visit me at thenaturalbirthcourse.com or connect with me on Instagram as The Natural Birth Podcast. Now, if you love this podcast, then please consider taking a moment right now and leave a review. They mean the world to me and is also your way of helping me reach more women around the world with these natural and empowering birth stories. Together, we are changing the birth narrative, one birth story at a time. Today on the Natural Birth Podcast, I will be the guest. Usually on this podcast, as you know, I am the host and I interview mamas from around the world who've had a natural and empowering birth experience. The intention with this podcast is to spread an alternative birth narrative to the dominant fear-based medicalized one. And I've come to be known as the spiritual midwife around the world by doing so. And that is what I'm here to talk about today, because I will no longer be called the spiritual midwife, but the spiritual midwitch. As of this year, 2023, I'm no longer a registered midwife and can therefore no longer legally call myself a midwife. And so in today's episode, I will share my her story, my journey of becoming a midwife, and then the choice to deregister and taking on the title of midwitch. I will start with reading a part of the chapter Her Story in Rachel Reed's book, Reclaiming Childbirth as a Rite of Passage, to set the scene. And this will then weave in perfectly into the reasons why I am stepping out of the system and why I can no longer call myself a midwife due to the powers to be who have stolen the word and made it criminal for me to do so. If you want to understand why our birth culture is the way it is, then this episode will start to explain that to you. And if you'd like to know more about our her story, about midwives, and how our birth culture came to be as it is today, then I invite you to read Reclaiming Childbirth as a Rite of Passage and or download Her Story, Womanifesto by Jane Hardwick Collins. You find the link to Jane's Her Story, Womanifesto in the show notes. This episode will introduce you a bit deeper to me, your host, Anna, the spiritual midwitch. This podcast is sponsored by Informed Pregnancy Plus, a brand new pregnancy and postpartum streaming platform featuring a rich and diverse and growing universe of thoughtfully created movies, documentaries, and series designed to entertain, empower, and promote health and wellness during your pregnancy and beyond. With Informed Pregnancy Plus, you can stream the documentary Heads Up, a series about breech births, or Trial of Labor, a film that follows a small group of pregnant women and their journeys back to trusting themselves and their bodies after a previous cesarean. One of my favorites is the movie These Are My Hours. It shows birth as mother-centric and autonomous, featuring poetic voiceover from the birthing mother and real-time labor footage and sounds. I cried watching this powerful movie, and it's now a part of my mentorship curriculum to watch. And the best news is that you can try Informed Pregnancy Plus absolutely free of charge. Just visit informedpregnancy.tv and start watching these inspiring documentaries and films already today. So here we are. We're here to talk about me moving from being a midwife to transitioning into calling myself and embodying the midwitch. And I want to take you on a journey with this story. So I want to start actually at the beginning with her story, kind of starting somewhere around the Middle Ages, talking about midwives, the birthing culture back then till now, weaving that her story about midwives and witches and the collective culture of birth and woman and womanhood. And then I want to weave the story of me, where I kind of started and how I ended up becoming a midwife, my journey as a midwife, and ultimately how I'm now decided to deregister as a registered midwife and enter into something new, something that I'm weaving now myself, still kind of trying on this name of midwitch and what that entails, what that's going to be for me. And I think it's going to continue to grow. So it's not something that it's clear cut. It's not like I just know now what that is for me, but I feel like there's more freedom in this name, in this title, and there's more of me in it. And I'm definitely not restrained to any institution or authority above me. I am sovereign as midwitch to be what I imagine the midwife back in the day were, especially before the Middle Ages, the time where, you know, for thousands and thousands of years, we had goddess worship and nature worship, and, you know, woman was revered. Birthing women were the symbol of God, the divine goddess. You know, then I imagine the midwife or the witch or the wise woman, the healer, whatever you want to call her, you know, was a central figure of the community, of the tribe, providing healing for all of them, both in birth and in death, knowing about the nature cycles, about the magic and the mystery of this life. And I want to take you on this journey now. I'm going to start this actually by reading Reclaiming Childbirth as a Rite of Passage. I'm going to read her story for you, and bear with me if I stumble on words or don't pronounce things right or so on and so forth. But I'm going to do my best, and I'm going to not read you the whole. I really recommend this book by Rachel Reed to anyone who's interested in childbirth as a rite of passage and reclaiming
that. But I'm going to read you part of that chapter starting at the Middle Ages. So before the Middle Ages, there was, you know, the sire from the male population to control woman and her sexuality and birth and what women can and cannot do, more or less, but it became stronger at this time. And it's really here I want to start talking about the witches and the midwives and the story I want to take you on. And the reason why is that I think that we need to start here to understand where we are today. And it will also make sense a little bit then also my reasoning and thinking around my, you know, self deregistering as a midwife controlled by the powers to be. I will start at Wise Women and Medicine Men, page 12 in Reclaiming Childbirth as a Rite of Passage. Throughout the Middle Ages, women continued to take responsibility for the domestic duties required to run their homes and raise children, depending on their class. They either carried out these necessary tasks themselves or paid other women to undertake domestic work. Women used folk medicine to care for sick family members and to manage their reproductive health. Folk medicine refers to the use of traditional remedies and was learned by observation and experience rather than formal education. Some women were particularly skilled in these practices and provided services for the community as healers and midwives. These wise women provided holistic care that included herbal remedies, chants, invocations, and charms. Wise women held status within their communities and could trade their services for money and goods. Some women also worked in the male-dominated healthcare professions as apothecaries and barber surgeons. During the Middle Ages, in addition to cutting hair, barber surgeons performed a range of surgical procedures such as bloodletting, tooth extraction, and even amputations. Women were usually involved in these professions because their fathers or husbands were. Since the 12th century, universities had been appearing throughout Europe, offering higher education to wealthy men. The curriculum was based on the tradition of knowledge that emerged from early Greek philosophers such as Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. Teachings rejected what was considered subjective ancient wisdom, favoring science and rationality. It was believed that nature could be understood best through intellectual analysis. Universities also reinforced religious and cultural ideas about the inferiority of women. However, they used science and claims of rationality rather than religious doctrine. They leaned heavily on Aristotle's description of women as inferior, passive species who were merely deformed men. It was within this belief system that men began to formally study medicine and become physicians. Male physicians were supported by the church and state, enabling them to position themselves as the only legitimate medical practitioners. Royal, religious, and academic decrees restricted the practice of medicine to licensed physicians only. A license could only be obtained after completing a university education to gain a formal qualification, then undertaking a clerical vow. Women were unable to access university education and were ineligible to take clerical vows. Male physicians also persuaded the English Parliament and King Henry to legislate that no woman was to use the practice of physics, thereby effectively banning women from practicing medicine and surgery. Unlicensed practitioners, including women, were permitted to provide healthcare within their limited scope, for example, dealing with minor problems such as boils. They were only allowed to charge small fees and were prohibited from advertising. Midwifery was not considered medical practice, and wise women continued to provide midwifery services without restriction. Despite attempts by male physicians to eradicate female healers, wise women maintained respect and status within their communities. People continued to engage their services because their cures were effective and their fees were affordable. In response, male physicians set about defaming wise women and their services. They accused them of contravening church law because they provided women with contraceptives, abortions, and herbs to ease labor pain. The church maintained that healing without a license was heresy. And if a woman dared to cure without having studied, she is a witch and must die. Therefore, male physicians claimed that wise women were practicing witchcraft. They also blamed sorcery when their university learned medicine failed to cure ailments. An early Latin translation for the ancient English word witch is wise woman. The oldest usage of the term witch refers to a woman of spiritual knowledge. Witches were healers, herbalists, diviners, invokers, and those with mystical knowledge. The old English meaning of the word craft included power, force, strength, cunning, knowledge, ability and skill, prescription and remedy. In the Middle Ages, European witches were also associated with the spinner goddess and nature worship. As the church suppressed the old religions and replaced them with Christianity, the word witch became linked with causing harm to others by using occult powers. However, the persecution of women for witchcraft predates accusations from male physicians. The Bible commands, "Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live." Women were burned for sorcery under Imperial Roman law. In the late 1800s in England, the Royal Code of Alfred the Great decreed exile or death for witches and unchaste women. The connection between witches and sexual freedom reflected concerns about the worship of fertility goddesses and celebration of female reproduction. The early witch persecutions aimed to suppress pagan practices among the poor people and maintain control over women. Women who lived independently of men, widows, and spinsters were targets. Their land and property could be taken from them if they were found guilty. It was feudal lords who carried out the early witch trials, and witch burnings were considered entertainment for aristocratic men. In the 1400s, witchcraft was declared the single greatest threat to Christian European civilization. In 1486, two Dominican inquisitors wrote a guide for witch hunting called Malleus Maleficarum, The Hammer of Witches. The book claimed that where there are many women, there are many witches, and when a woman thinks alone, she thinks evil. The content reflected beliefs about women that were held by Christianity and medicine. Women are witches because, like Eve, they are feebler both in mind and body than men, more impressionable, credulous, and carnal. Formed from a bent rib, they are defective. Their slippery tongues cannot keep silent. Witch hunts spread like plague across Europe and New England. continuing into the 18th century. Male physicians participated by providing medical expertise regarding whether a woman was a witch or not. This often involved carrying out invasive physical examinations of the woman's body. Estimates of how many people were killed vary from hundreds of thousands to millions. Men were also victims of the witch hunts. However, 85% of those killed were women, mostly poor, illiterate women and girls. In addition to those executed, many more were tortured, and the systemic persecution of witches generated fear and silence amongst women. It became dangerous to practice these healing arts. The witch hunts eliminated the majority of wise women and their wisdom, creating the opportunity for male physicians to take possession of medical practice and knowledge. Naturally, during the Middle Ages, midwives were at risk of being accused of witchcraft, and their practice came under scrutiny and suspicion. Childbirth was women's business and occurred in the home, away from the direct control of the church or state. It was well known that midwives used charms and spells and incantations to assist women during labor. Midwives also had expertise in contraception and abortion and were believed to assist with infanticide. In an attempt to gain control over midwifery practice, the church and secular governments began to regulate them already there. For example, in England, midwives were required to be examined and admitted to practice by a bishop. The English Midwives' Oath from 1567 required midwives to pledge that they will not use any kind of sorcery or incantation in the time of the travail of any woman. Superstition surrounded particular elements of childbirth, such as the placenta, the umbilical cord, and the caul, a piece of amniotic membrane that sometimes cover the baby's head at birth. Regulations were published that forbade midwives from taking the placenta or caul in case they used them for witchcraft. Unsurprisingly, midwives made up a significant portion of those killed during the witch hunts. Despite losing control of medicine, women retained control of childbearing throughout the Middle Ages. Pregnancy, childbirth, and early mothering were considered normal life events that did not require medical practitioners. The legitimate scope of the wise woman was now limited to midwifery. In Old English, the word midwife literally means with woman. Midwives relied on women requesting their services to make a living. In this way, they were chosen and sustained by the community. However, midwives also collaborated with the church and state in their work. They had a role in asserting paternity and providing legal witness to births. Attempts to license midwives occurred throughout the 1600s and 1700s with varying success. Gaining a license required the midwife to supply testimonials of her practice, pay a fee, and take an oath that she was of sober life and conversation. The Catholic Church gave midwives the right to baptize babies in utero to save the baby's soul if death was imminent. Midwives carried a device that could squirt holy water into women's vaginas and onto the baby for this purpose. Midwives were also required to refer complicated births to male physicians. However, physicians had no training or experience in childbirth, and midwives could usually manage complications themselves. Therefore, physicians were rarely called to a birth. Childbirth remained a female-only event that sustained the collective culture of women via the ceremony of childbirth. Midwives attended births, providing oversight and administering the woman's caudal, a warmed drink consisting of ale or wine with sugar and spices. they were also required to identify and manage complications. Gossips, or persons invited to a birth for the subsequent purpose of baptism, provided the majority of the emotional and physical support for women. The word gossip is a corruption of the word godsib or godsibling. By the 1700s, gossips came to refer specifically to women who attended births in groups. Gossips were invited to a birth by the mother and were female relatives and close friends of the woman. They prepared the house for birth and the arrival of the baby, cared for siblings, and provided practical and emotional support to the birthing woman. Gossips then visited the woman during her postnatal lying period to assist with house chores and childcare. They also took the baby to be baptized because the mother was expected to remain indoors until her churching a month after birth. During churching, the woman attended church to be ritually purified and returned into society. In the villages and towns of Western Europe, there was male hostility to the ceremony of childbirth because it involved women gathering behind closed doors for significant amounts of time. There were concerns that they were neglecting their domestic duties and husbands, and suspicion about what was being discussed. Women also celebrated the birth of babies with alcohol and merriment during the postnatal period. In the late 16th century, several town governments in England attempted to regulate women's childbirth festivities, particularly during the lying-in period. Gossips were vilified and their role in the childbirth ceremony mocked. This response is illustrated by a satirical poem written in the 1600s titled Tittle Tattle, or the Several Branches of Gossiping. The poem begins, "At childbed, when the gossips meet, fine stories, we are told, and if they get a cup too much, their tongues they cannot hold." The subsequent verses detail where gossips meet and how they behave, and the final verse reads, "Then gossips all our warning take, pray cease your tongue to rattle. Go knit and sew and brew and bake and leave off tittle-tattle." The development of science contributed to the shift of power in childbirth. In the 16th century, male philosophers laid the foundations for modern-day approaches to scientific thinking and knowledge. From these foundations, a new mechanistic philosophy of the human body emerged. The universe was conceived as a huge machine governed by laws that could be understood through reason. The human body was also considered in terms of a machine, and childbirth was described as a mechanical process. Men were believed to be more mechanically minded than women, therefore better suited to understanding bodies. They began to study childbirth and developed a new understanding of it, with accompanying language that enabled them to move into the female-controlled territory of childbirth and redefined it. The invention of medical instruments offered a new response to complicated births. In the 13th century, the establishment of the Barber Surgeons Guild had secured the right of men to use surgical instruments to remove a dead baby to save the mother. Subsequent knowledge of anatomy and physiology enabled men to develop further technology. In the 1600s, a physician named Peter Chamberlain, a barber surgeon, invented forceps, which for the first time enabled the delivery of a live baby when labor became dangerous. The design of these instruments were kept secret by the family for generations, allowing them to charge a very high price for rescuing mothers and babies. Once other barber surgeons worked out the design, they could also offer the intervention. Barber surgeons could now rescue both baby and mother and become known as man midwives or accouchers, specializing in complicated births. Women were banned from using these instruments, and man midwives became the predecessors of obstetricians. The use of technology in conjunction with science increased the status of male birth knowledge and helped facilitate their eventual move into uncomplicated birth in the 1800s and into the present day. The social and cultural climate was rapidly changing during the rise of man midwife, and these changes added to the erosion of traditional female practice. The professionalization of many occupations gradually excluded women, and there was a general loss of female occupations to men. Simultaneously, increasing industrialization led to trades becoming separated from the home. Most women were unable to work in these trades because of their responsibility within the home. Women who could work in factories no longer attended births as gossips due to their work patterns. And over time, the collective culture of women at birth became unsustainable. In France, the man midwife became popular with wealthy, literary women because he presented proof of their social status. These women embraced their new scientific philosophy and its technology. In 1617, Louise Bourgeois, a French midwife, protested about this trend and complained about the coquettes who employed male midwives even for normal birth. In the rest of Europe, including England, men were still only employed to assist during complicated births. Male midwives capitalized on this by exaggerating the dangers of childbirth and then integrating the compensation and the competence of female midwives. Wealthy women employed male midwives to wait in their home during birth in case they were needed to manage a complication. Before the new scientific philosophy, women had built up a body of female knowledge about childbirth, disseminated via their oral culture. This knowledge sat outside formal education from which they had historically been excluded. The shift towards book learning enabled men to publish medical texts that communicated their understanding of birth and further reinforced their authority in this area. Traditional female midwives faced difficulties articulating the nature of their knowledge. Their knowledge was less empirical, and they learned through apprenticeships and experience rather than books. When formal midwifery education was eventually introduced in the 18th century, it was based on the mechanistic understanding of birth created by men and led to the further suppression of traditional midwifery knowledge. Medical knowledge about the human body continued to be constructed around sex-based stereotypes. Because women are capable of creating children, it was assumed that this was their primary biological role. Women were considered feeble of mind and victim to their reproductive urges. Rudolf Virchow, the father of modern pathology, stated that a woman is a pair of ovaries with a human being attached, whereas a man is a human being furnished with a pair of testes. Female diseases and illnesses were explained as symptoms of women resisting or denying their biological destiny. Rational male medicine purported to be able to diagnose, treat, and control women's disordered bodies. In Europe and in the United States, industrialization led to crowded living conditions and increased ill health and injury. Hospitals were established to provide large-scale medical care where patients could be managed by doctors and tended to by nurses. In the 18th century, lying-in hospitals were set up to provide free care to poor women and obstetric training for doctors and nurses. However, hospital conditions were crowded and unsanitary, and rates of childbed fever were high as doctors spread bacteria from ill and dead patients directly into birthing women's vaginas. The rates of maternal death due to infection would remain high until the discovery of antibiotics in the 20th century. Initially, the rates of injury and death for mothers and babies rose as hospital birth increased. Despite this, over many decades, hospital birth became common for women of all classes. Hospitals and medicine offered pain relief and a sense of safety that filled the vacuum created by the collapse of the collective birthing culture of women. Many first wave feminists considered the option of a medicalized hospital birth as a means of women gaining control over their body and reproductive life. They argued for the right to relieve the pain and suffering associated with pregnancy and birth. Nonetheless, despite a move towards hospital birth, home birth with the care of a midwife remained a cultural norm across Europe and beyond until the second half of the 20th century. During this time, midwives continued to provide care for the women in their communities as they had done for centuries. In the 20th century, as more women birthed in the hospital, the medicalization of childbirth began in earnest. Obstetricians and hospital-trained midwives became the primary carers for birthing women. Hospital practices were also influenced by the mass production concepts of industrialization. Women's bodies were managed as though they were on a production line, with routine interventions aimed at making the birth process more effective and efficient. The rise of obstetrics and its eventual dominance over midwifery in the Western world was achieved by the argument that those who cared for the female body could only do so by viewing it as a machine to be supervised, controlled, and interfered with by technical means. Standard interventions include a pubic shave, enema, and bath, followed by rupturing the amniotic sac with the AmniHook. Narcotics and sedation were then administered to induce a twilight sleep, and women were strapped to beds to avoid injuring themselves as they thrashed about, partially conscious. As the baby's head appeared, medication was injected to increase contractions, and forceps were used to remove the baby from the unconscious woman. In many cases, women would wake up from their twilight sleep with no memory of the birth and their baby already in the nursery. Babies would be brought to their mother for breastfeeding at specific times dictated by hospital routines. In Europe, between the late 1800s and the early 1900s, medicine forged an allegiance with nursing to bring midwifery under the legal and disciplinary control of medicine. Various strategic legislations resulted in midwifery becoming a branch of nursing rather than a profession, separate it had always been. Whereas traditional midwifery evolved from the autonomous, wise woman and her folk medicine, traditional nursing had emerged to support medical practice. Midwives were now educated and socialized as nurses first, then taught the knowledge and skills required to support medicalized birth. Moreover, midwives could not regulate their own profession. Instead, medicine and nursing had a dominant voice in their government. In parts of North America, midwifery was effectively outlawed, and maternity care was provided only by obstetricians and nurses. World War II resulted in many young men being killed and a subsequent need to replace them within the population. As in previous eras, war increased the interest and control of women's reproduction. Institutionalized antenatal care was implemented to improve the health of the population by surveillance and control of women's pregnancy. During this time, European midwives still provided antenatal care and postnatal care in their communities. However, even more women chose to give birth in hospital, and this became the new cultural norm. The need to ensure a healthy population also led to medical advancements in diagnosis and treatment of complications of childbearing, such as preeclampsia and postpartum hemorrhage. Therefore, women with complicated pregnancies began to have access to more efficient treatment and management in hospital settings. However, obstetric medicine continued to develop its knowledge of childbirth based on the 17th century concept of the body as a machine. The birth process was broken down into distinct stages that could be measured and plotted against timelines. This categorization allowed practitioners to measure progress through defined stages and create limits and boundaries around what was considered normal. It was believed that medicine and technology could make the woman's body more efficient at birthing. In the 1950s, an American obstetrician named Emanuel Friedman plotted onto a graph the cervical dilatation of 500 women having their first baby in a hospital. The study population included women who were sedated and had medication to induce or speed up their labor, and 55% had forceps. In the 1970s, Friedman's graph was modified to guide practitioners working in a remote area of Rhodesia. The intention was to reduce the incidence of poor outcomes associated with obstructed labor in this particular setting, and an alert line, a transfer to hospital line, and an action to augment line were added to Friedman's graph. The result was the partogram, a graph that plots cervical dilatation during labor across a timeline. By the 1980s, the partogram had been implemented into hospitals worldwide and is still used today to monitor and define normal progress of labor. Evidence-based medicine emerged in the 1970s, but did not become firmly established in healthcare until the early 1990s. Obstetric resistance to implementing research findings into practice was well known among other specialties of medicine. Routine interventions such as fetal monitoring, breaking the amniotic sac, and episiotomies were introduced as part of the general medicalization of childbirth without any supporting research evidence. These interventions continue to be practiced with the onus on researchers to demonstrate it is safe and effective to stop carrying them out. However, even with good quality research evidence, obstetric practice remains culture-based rather than evidence-based. Many routine birth interventions are in direct opposition to the current research evidence and contradict modern knowledge about birth physiology. For example, the partogram remains firmly embedded in hospital practice despite good research demonstrating it is ineffective at determining normal labor. That is a brief summary of a part of her story. I recommend that you read this book by Rachel Reed. I will also link in the show notes her story by Jane Harvey Collins that goes through as much as kind of we know about her story, as it was obviously a oral tradition. And so much has been lost because of the witch hunting and burning for so many hundreds of years. Truly, you know, a persecution of women, women culture. So I wanted to share this with you because this so influenced my decision making in stepping out of being an institutionalized, controlled, registered midwife. Because believe it or not, not much has changed. It looks different today. The language is different. It's a birthing culture that is so dominant, it's not questioned until a woman goes through birth and experience obstetric violence or birth trauma, or midwives like me leave the system and speak out. And because of the witch hunts, because of the history of women, that it's been so dangerous for so many thousands of years of being a woman, and we have been hunted for having a voice, for being a woman. We've been criminalized for having female sexuality, for, you know, just absolutely everything about being a woman. Our throat chakra, our voices, daring to actually be seen and heard in our authentic voice, has been, you know, the scariest thing. And for me too, believe it or not. And still, so many of us women are keeping silent, and I will no longer stand for it. And I had to deregister to fully actually own my voice and speak the truth without the fear of being prosecuted by the institutions to be, and by actually fellow midwives within those institutions, because they hold the patriarchy strongest. Women usually hold that internalized patriarchy strongest towards each other, to keep each other in line. And this, you know, I'm not blaming women for this or midwives for this. It's because of her story. That's why I wanted to share it. So let me tell you about my her story. Not my whole life, but I'm going to share kind of my journey to who I became, I guess, in my professional life and who I am in the world. And it really starts early. You know, I was always a different kind of child. I was always very intuitive. I would speak truth. I have this thing. I somehow don't have a filter, but I just speak truth from my heart. And I always do it from the heart. I always come from love and wanting to help. As a child, I would do that probably more so than I should. And it wasn't always well received by both other kids, but also adults. But I started sitting in women's circles already as a 14, 15-year-old, as I was really struggling in the normal society. Somehow I found these women's circles run by shamans and a woman who called herself a witch. I sat in these circles and learned from women much older than myself. And I felt normal in these circles. Others who spoke of women having intuition, that was something that was normal. And when society did not say that. And I dove into nature medicine as a 17-year-old, 18-year-old. I studied herbs and different massage therapies, some Ayurveda and Chinese medicine, a bit of the, you know, European Western herb traditions, and kind of nature medicine, that which women did back in the day. I didn't know that then, but that's what I was doing as a 17, 18-year-old. Then I moved into human rights because I had this really strong right and wrong pathos. And, you know, I was so devastated by the world as a teenager, so devastated to see the inequalities amongst peoples and minorities and women, realizing, I can still remember how gut-wrenching it was to realize that I was, as a woman, somehow less worth than my brother in the world. And I recognized really early that distinction about society not valuing woman as much as man. And so I studied human rights for a year as a 19-year-old, I think 20-year-old. Before and during that time, I also worked with the Red Cross and different NGOs. I was very involved with refugees, women's rights, children's rights. I started this project for families who were on the verge of homelessness and for their kids. I was very involved in the community, wanting to help and serve. I'm a Virgo, if you know about star signs, and I really have that of service very strong in me. I want to serve and I want to help. But I was studying human rights and I was doing that. And I became very, very dark because it just felt very dark. Like essentially we just don't have any rights, or I became very dark in that place. So I decided to take off from Sweden, where I'm born and raised and from, and went out into the world, and I decided to go to Australia. And I absolutely fell in love with Australia. I spent some time as a backpacker, you know, going through the Red Center, seeing Uluru, loving the desert, absolutely loving it, and just having this sense of really sensing spirit so deeply in the earth in Australia. There was a connection there that I had never felt. I really felt that dreaming. I really felt the anchor that the peoples of Australia, the indigenous peoples of Australia, have created for so many thousands and thousands and thousands of years. It's in the air, it's in the just in the feeling of that country, especially in the desert, especially in the Red Center.
Are you ready to join me and others in being a part of the movement of the reclaiming of birth as a rite of passage and as a woman's sacred business? I'm calling you who recognizes birth as a sacred portal and a life-altering event worthy of honoring and safeguarding. You who want to walk alongside women through her rite of passage from maiden to mother and provide a safe, sacred, and physiological birth space. Here's your invitation to join me and other women from around the world in the Sacred Birthworker Mentorship Program, becoming a sacred birth advocate and space holder, the Beyond a Doula training, starting in January 2024. It's a full year's container of learning, embodying, and deepening into a true space holder and sacred advocate for a woman's rite of passage of birth. By weaving ancient and modern knowledge of her story, women's wisdom, physiological birth skills, and the art of sacred space holding, as well as diving into the variations of normal, medicalized birth, birth advocacy within the current unnatural maternity system, and so much more. This program is unique to its kind in its depth and how deep we go, and also that I offer you one-on-one mentoring with me personally assisting you in becoming the clear channel and the best space holder that you can be. You will be so held and so nurtured and so supported for a whole year inside our worldwide online community as you learn and embody the teachings and skills and start sharing your gifts with the world. If your intuition is ringing clear as you receive this invitation, find out more and apply at thenaturalbirthcourse.com or via the link in the show notes.
That's where I went first, and I spent like a month or more there, maybe even two, throughout the whole Red Center, from the base of Adelaide all the way up to Darwin. And then I spent some time on the East Coast, but not until I actually flew over to the West Coast, to Perth and Fremantle, and I was hit by this heat and dry heat and smell of eucalyptus in the middle of the night. I just knew as I arrived that I'd come home. And I did spend years back and forth in this place, the earth. But in between, I was back and forth in Sweden, and I studied again. I studied to become a yoga teacher, life coach, massage therapist, spa therapist. I did travels around the world as well. I was back and forth to Australia. I went to Asia, India, Thailand, especially. I went and I studied women's tantra, women's kind of ancient women's business, ceremony, ritual, dance from all over the world, women's traditional dances. And I learned more and more about feminine embodiment, embodying our cycles, our rites of passages, loving our feminine body, our sexuality as holy, sacred. And I started to weave all my knowledge from all those years of studying all those different things. I started to weave something I call temples for women, something I've done now for 10, 15 years. I think I started calling them Shakti workshops, actually, to be honest. And then pretty quickly, I moved into calling them temples. And that's how they've been known. And I started to actually travel the world with that. During this time too, I was working, I started a yoga house for a while. I call it House Harmony, where I had my circles and my yoga classes. And I also provided massage and coaching and counseling. And I was a consultant to other retreat centers around Sweden, eventually the world. I was traveling as well with my temple groups and my Kundalini yoga workshops, and I was weaving my own programs and retreats and courses. And then as a 28-year-old woman, I decided to go back to the other side of the world yet again. Been back and forth plenty of times, but I decided, okay, I'm going to go to New Zealand for a while. And I was there for half a year teaching at different festivals and studios, and was also called in by women who wanted me to facilitate retreats for them, and specifically for their groups of women. And then I was thinking, oh, I'm just going to go back to Australia to visit a friend in Byron Bay. And we were going to do some work together for women, sacred feminine work. And I got stuck. I was so well received by the community in Byron, and I ended up staying for half a year and realizing, oh my gosh, I love this place. And for the first time in my adult life since I was 17, I had not lived anywhere more than a year. And here I was, and I felt called to stay. And I had in New Zealand met this beautiful woman, Rachel. She's on this podcast, I think the first season. She shares about her birth and also her first birth, which was a stillborn baby. And I was so inspired by her. And she was so very much involved in the home birthing scene, both in Australia and in New Zealand. And I learned that, you know, in New Zealand, midwives were very much more autonomous. You could go straight into being a home birth midwife. And I naively thought that Australia was the same. So I decided to become a midwife in Australia. And that's really what happened. It wasn't a long period of thinking about that. It was kind of, I knew some other midwives. I was in an area where 25% of women home birthed. The rest, almost all, would birth at the birth center, which was, you know, just a home away from home kind of thing. All midwifery-led care, continuity of care, which is, you know, the most excellent way. And I thought, brilliant, you know, if I study here, I can walk alongside these midwives and I can learn from them. And I can be that kind of midwife. Because I knew in Sweden, where I was from, you had to become a nurse first. So very much, you know, as you just heard in her story, the control of midwifery so strong all over the world, with very few exceptions. And in Sweden, it's so controlled by medicine, by institutions to be. And you have to be a nurse first, and then you become a midwife. And I had no desire to be a nurse. I did not want to work in hospitals. Don't like hospitals. So that was never even a thought. Like it crossed my mind about midwifery, but it just as easily left my mind because I was like, never would I do that. So when I was in Byron, I just something awoke in me that I wanted to be a midwife. I wanted to be authentic, home birth midwife, traditional midwife. And I thought that I could do that as it was in New Zealand. I thought it was the same. It was not. I still had an education that was very rare, and I'm very grateful for it because I've now realized that compared to the rest of the world, maybe except New Zealand, and maybe, you know, there's some different kind of, you know, midwifery schools in the US that are not, you know, nurse based and, you know, more like the straight entry kind of apprenticeship, home birth midwife trainings. I don't know anywhere else in the world really where you truly have the opportunity to walk alongside home birth midwives, birth center birth midwives, and see so much physiological births, natural births that I did in my education. And that was just because I lived in the area that I lived. So I lived in the Byron Shire, where again, you know, so many people home birth or birth in the birth center with continuity of care midwives. So I did my education at uni for 3 years. I got that university degree, which was good and bad, I think, you know, it was a mixed pot there. And then I did prac in a tertiary hospital. I did a prac in a hospital, still in an area close to Byron. So a lot of women coming to that hospital wanted natural births. And there was some midwives that were also home birth midwives, or just like not indoctrinated obstetric nurses. And there was also obstetricians, a few of them, maybe a couple, that were very woman-centered, that had seen a lot of natural births, that trusted women, that honored their choices. There's one obstetrician that is known for that, you know, for assisting vaginal twin birth and bridge birth, and even doing lotus birth at cesareans, and very like family-friendly, woman-friendly. So even my hospital prac was in a hospital that wasn't maybe the typical Australian hospital or in the world kind of thing. So even there, I could see natural births, which is, again, like super rare in hospitals, like super duper very, very rare. So all in all, you know, I did that. And then I also did continuity of care throughout my whole degree, following families from pregnancy. I was at the birth and in, you know, 4 to 6 weeks postpartum. And so I got that real scope of practice that is so, again, rare. You know, that is not something that they do here in Sweden, for example. And then I got to do my mentorship also with the Byron midwives that do both home birth and birth center births. And that really was my education. You know, my first kind of 24 hours was, as a first year student, I first got to witness a shoulder dystocia emergency kind of situation in hospital, and that kind of birth experience compared to just like 24 hours later, within those 24 hours, a beautiful home birth, a water birth. Both were first time mamas. So I'm so grateful for that. And I tended to also attract just normal throughout my student years. I had a hard time. I had to like come back, I think, for extra shifts to actually see more cesareans, because I just never, my women that I cared for tended to birth naturally, not even with epidurals or needing a cesarean. So I was, you know, during 3 years, like I just rarely got to see that. Whereas a lot of people in my cohort who did not live in my area, who then did their prac in other tertiary hospitals up the coast, that were very different culture, much more kind of the common culture of birth, never almost saw spontaneous labor, and natural labor and birth, and just saw so much medicalization and complications. So I was kind of, I was seeing so much normal and learning so much normal and variations of normal and how to support women in physiological birth, holding a sacred space for that. And also obviously coming from my background, holding sacred space for women was and is what I do. So I came also with that approach. I came with that energy of being able to hold sacred space already. So I brought that into the birth space as well. And then I went out as a graduate midwife in Australia. You kind of have to work in hospitals and do that graduate year in hospitals. And I did in a small country hospital that was supposed to be low risk, but I think had like a 40% cesarean rate because of the obstetricians were just so happy to do that so easily. I learned a lot from being in that country hospital. I was left alone a lot. Half of my shifts was like by myself, night shifts, afternoon shifts. I had another midwife that would be on call, but she would be like half an hour away if I called her in for an emergency or just that a birth, you know, birthing woman came in or something. Otherwise, I would tend to that ward. There was a lot to navigate by myself without any midwifery manager, without any other midwife there. But that was the wild west in Australia. That was my graduate year. And I lasted almost a year and then I gave my resignation. I just felt that I couldn't stand it because what I truly felt being a midwife in a hospital was that I had to be participating in trauma and causing trauma to women. And I was feeling so frustrated and so angry and so sad. And I was just like, how can I help women? Because women would just come on in and just be so happy to be patients and then just, you know, coming out with birth trauma and just being so much being done to them. And I had to, as a midwife in the system, you know, you have to, you're employed and your allegiance lies with the hospital and you have to tick all these boxes and all this admin and I just could not do it. I could not be in that system anymore with all these things that were done to women. So I resigned and I decided to start the spiritual midwife. That's how the spiritual midwife came to be. The day I resigned is when I started my Instagram, I think. We're very close to. And shortly after that, I was like, I'm going to make the natural birth course and I'm going to tell women how they can prepare and optimize their chances of having a natural physiological birth wherever they want to have that, because let's face it, most women will birth in hospitals. That is just how it is, and we can discuss that back and forth, but that is just what most women will do. And so I made a course that would suit anyone, whether you had a home birth, birth center birth, or a hospital birth. And I wanted women to know more, be more prepared, claim their birth. And so I spent the next couple of months creating the natural birth course. I also went home to Sweden where my dad had gotten cancer and stage 3, so quite progressed, and saw him. He chose to go the conventional route of doing chemo and all that that entails. So I was with him with his decision making in that. It's not unfortunately as open to my wisdom as many of you are. So anyways, I respect his choices. It's not my life, it's his. And so that's where he went and what he did. And I was with him for that for 6 weeks before I went back to Australia and continued. I was going to start holding kind of birth education classes, and I'll do all this, you know, work for women. But then COVID hit. I literally got back to Australia, and just a month later, we all got, you know, told to stay in our houses. And so life changed. And I decided, well, I was thinking of starting a podcast, so I might as well just do that then. And here we are. Like, I don't know how many years later. What is it? 3.5 years later or something, which is amazing. And so I interviewed mostly friends and clients. I didn't say that though in the podcast in the beginning. I don't know why. I was just really trying to let the woman have her story, and still do. And so I interviewed people that I knew about their natural and empowering birth stories. And I did a whole season at once, and I released it at once. And then I started, I think I started on Mother's Day, I think, in Australia. And then I made the nursing postpartum course. I started attending home births in the Byron Shire, and life pottered along. I loved creating this podcast. I loved attending home births. I loved educating. I started educating around the world. Women would privately, obviously, employ me. And also, you know, I coached women around the world. I did a lot of birth debriefing from women who've had birth trauma. And that kind of potted along. I also created a feminine leadership mentorship that wasn't connected to birth work, but because I was still doing my templates with women and women's circles and women's work, I had a lot of women that were interested in doing that kind of mentorship with me. So I created that and I did that. And then it just didn't seem that, you know, the world would ever stop being, or Australia, being locked down. And as I told you, my dad has cancer, and I don't know how long I have with him. And, you know, a year went by, and Australia, definitely there was scary stuff going on in Australia when it comes to their, how they handled COVID and how they treated people. Mandates and all these kinds of stuff that, you know, many of you recognize from around the world, depending on where you were. Sweden didn't do that. Sweden never did those things. There was no lockdowns. There were no mandates. So in one sense, Sweden was a bit different from the rest of the world. Australia was quite bad. And so there was a lot of fear in the air. But I was, you know, well cared for. I don't know, by universe, by spirit. I seemed to end up in places where I had like one weekend of actual lockdown in Byron during 2 years. And it actually wasn't locked down. It was, or was it? It was something that weekend anyways, where I just chose to stay at home. But otherwise it was quite free, and that area is quite free, and a bit of rebels living there kind of as well. So I just ended up being in Queensland or New South Wales when it was quite open, and still working and doing my thing. And then I decided that in 2021 that it was time to maybe return to Sweden. With all that I was, you know, my dad being sick, the lockdowns that didn't seem to be lifting. And when I did leave in July 2021 for the next half year in Byron, it was quite bad for another few months or half a year before it eased up and then Australia opened up. But, you know, I left not really knowing, I guess, when Australia would stop being crazy and not letting me leave. And you could only leave if you were actually leaving the country. Like, Australians weren't allowed to leave at that point, but I could leave because I was Swedish and I was moving back home. So there you go. That was how I left Australia. And I came back here, and the story is this, that my education in Australia is not valid here in Sweden. Because remember, here you have to be a nurse first before you can become a midwife. So I came back and I was like, well, you know, I'll just do my spiritual midwifery business. Like, you know, I have my courses that I sell and offer. I have my coaching, you know, education, coaching around the world by Zoom and also, of course, in person. And I was thinking, you know, I'll just do that. But then I was invited by another midwife who was registered in Sweden to work in partnership with her as kind of a doula. But she would be the primary midwife and I would kind of be, you know, her teammate. So women would employ us as a midwife and a midwife doula or spiritual midwife, you know. So we did that. It was amazing. And I'm really grateful to her because that opened up for me that, okay, I can work in this way. So as I was working, which was great, I started getting people asking me if I did any kind of doula training, if I had any courses in that. And I was like, no, but maybe in the future. And I kept being asked that. And then that kind of intensified during 2022 in the autumn, winter time. And so I was like, okay, I seem to be called to be doing something. And so I created what I now call the Sacred Birthworker Mentorship. I began calling it the Spiritual Midwife Mentorship. And so I created this mentorship that was going to be for a whole year, but the intense part of learning was a half a year. And then was kind of supportive space and like meeting once a month for the next 6 months in that year to kind of help hold that sacred space for the birth workers to implement and come out into the world and become these sacred birth advocates and space holders that they had cultivated to be throughout my mentorship. So that's where I moved into. I moved into being a mentor for other birth workers or those who want to be birth workers. So I have women who are nurses or former nurses, doulas, that recognize that their training was not enough for what they actually wanted to be able to provide for women. And just mothers who had natural and empowering births themselves, or maidens that are just birth nerds and love birth and want to step into this space and want to become, maybe was thinking of becoming doulas, but also again, recognizing that those trainings weren't aligning with them. They wanted more deeper knowledge base and they wanted to really cultivate themselves. They recognized that cultivating themselves was important to be those sacred space holders for this portal. So I launched it in May 2023, which was also the month that I deregistered as a midwife. You might wonder why I did that. So again, one of the biggest reasons was that that I could not work in Sweden anyways. And this is going to be my base now. If I wanted to be a midwife in Sweden, I had to become a nurse. I would have to go 3 years to uni to become a nurse. And I have zero interest in becoming a nurse. And I have zero interest in learning about diseases of pathology and working in hospitals. Had I still been in Australia, you know, working as a home birth midwife would have been, and or if I could have done that here in Sweden, I would have done that. I have some beautiful home birth midwife friends here in Sweden that are doing amazing work for women. They're few, but they exist, and I'm going to do everything in my power to help them and to work for midwifery in Sweden, because I am passionate about midwifery. I'm passionate about true midwifery. I'm passionate about continuity of care. I'm passionate about woman-centered care. I'm a passionate freaking midwife that cannot no longer call myself a midwife, because it is a criminal offense if you are not registered to call yourself a midwife. That title is protected by the powers to be, stolen, I would say. So even though I am a midwife and I have a midwife, you know, midwifery training, I've worked as a midwife, I have this amazing knowledge base that very few actually in Sweden have and the world have because of my unique training and how I've worked and all the physiological births I've seen. Like my embodied knowing of physiology, I've actually really come to understand that the last few years when I speak to other midwives, doesn't even come close to most midwives around the world and in Sweden, for example. And that's just the truth. I didn't realize that until I came back to Sweden and also just getting to know so many midwives around the world and, you know, their trainings and their experience. So, but I cannot call myself a midwife because I've decided to step out and not be registered. So I couldn't be registered in Sweden anyways. And in Australia, you have to be practicing to hold be registered. You can be a non-practicing registered midwife, but I also felt that that body that kind of regulates then midwives, me, it is nursing and medicine kind of ruled. Again, like just like the book said, just like how, you know, it's been, I feel less free. And also there's that fear of prosecution from other midwives that might not like me speaking out about how it actually is. Because again, like there's this culture of silence. And I'm so sick of it because it's this idea that we don't want to scare women. We don't really want to tell them how bad the system is of midwives. And one in three women get birth trauma. And I want to be free to speak the truth and the full truth because I believe that women are wise. I believe that women can take the truth and make informed decisions. And I feel like we all owe it to women to tell the truth so they can make informed decisions. And not just say that, yes, walk into the hospital and just wing it and, you know, you'll have your natural birth or you'll have an empowering positive birth, whatever birth you have a natural birth, physiological birth, medicalized birth, induction, epidural, cesarean, whatever, you know, there can be a positive and empowering birth, whatever kind of birth you have, but it's about making informed decisions. And that is not happening. And it needs to stop. And I feel like by deregistering, I no longer carry that last piece of fear of the institution. It just felt like freedom to me. There's so much, they put so much fear in you, also at uni, about what you can and cannot do and that kind of overseeing institution that's going to govern you and that can threaten, coerce, punish you. And, you know, there's a lot of tales around that. And especially when it comes to being independent midwives are today's witches. They are hunted and they're sacrificed at the altar all the time. If women just knew the risk that independent midwives take to follow her passion and her true belief to serve women, and, you know, they get reported by other midwives, by doctors, usually by women, you know, and even if everything goes well, still there might be some midwife or midwives that will gang up on her and report her. And then she's under investigation and that can go on for years. And the toll that takes on her mentally, emotionally, on all levels, it is a witch hunt. And I really want you guys to know that. Being an independent midwife today is a brave thing to be because you are, you are facing prosecution. And most independent midwives, I would say, or many at least, will have had, you know, someone report them or, yeah, being involved with this institution that regulates them. And also that means also that most independent midwives goes under the radar. They hide. They hide as witches. They hide so that they, you know, hopefully won't be prosecuted. So that's where I am going. Like, okay, well, if I deregister, I can speak truth and there's no one to punish me. for it. Ah, long story short.
Makes me really sad. Makes me really sad that this is the truth, but this is the truth and we need to speak about it. We're living in a new age now. Things are shifting. Things are changing. Women are waking up. People are waking up. More and more people are realizing we need to value freedom and sovereignty above the illusion of safety and you know, fear. And I love that. And I have gotten outpour of people celebrating that I'm deregistered and seeing where it comes from, understanding that it comes from the true desire in me to serve women and serve on a bigger scale than just the women that I work with one-on-one, but to actually dare to be the bold truth speaker that I've always been, that has always gotten me in trouble. It's hard to be that person that doesn't toe the line. Not popular. I've never been popular. And I do grieve that. And it makes me angry that they own the word midwife, because midwife, it's an ancient word and belongs to women. It belongs to the birthing culture of women. And not to the institutions who now own it. That makes me into a criminal, calling myself a midwife. So I deregistered in May 2023. And then, it's now, end of September, beginning of October when this is aired. And it's been a process of like, what am I going to call myself? Because I felt so identified with my name, the spiritual midwife. Midwife being with woman, everything I've done my whole life has been being with woman as a woman's work facilitator, feminine embodiment coach, a circle leader with women, coaching women, guiding women, assisting women, serving women in different spaces, in ceremony, in ritual, in birth, postpartum, midwife. That word, the true meaning of the word is me. Like I could change my actual like name from Anna to midwife. Like that would feel true, but not what midwife means now, which is being an obstetric nurse to the medical establishment. That has, from the first week when I went into midwifery school, I cried the first week realizing what I was getting myself into. And it was 4 years really of being in purgatory sometimes, really the feeling like there was just so much trauma. I feel like I have PTSD from that training, being in the hospital system, not being in home births, not being in the birth center, but being in the hospitals. Just the memories, the flashbacks I can have of what has been done to women in my presence that I have not been able to stop, that I feel that I am a part of. That midwife I am not. And that is what midwife have come to mean, truly. Even though most people don't understand that. It should be called obstetric nurse. It should not be called midwife. Yeah. So, midwitch it is. Witch for me, it's also a loaded word that so many people think that witch, it's been ridiculed. It's shown as, as a cartoon of a ugly old woman, right? That is evil. not, you know. Many witches were midwives. The wise woman, the healer, the one who serves families. That is me. So midwitch felt like a combination of midwife and witch, and yeah, I guess that's me. A midwitch, one who, you know, it also feels expansive because it opens it up to my other work that I haven't, you know, under the spiritual midwife, haven't really brought in, which is my temples, the circles I hold for women. You know, sitting in circle is this ancient thing that women have done throughout the ages. And one of the things that I love most in this life is to sit in circles of women, the wisdom, the potency, the sacredness. You know, I do that both in person and obviously online in my, the Maiden Mother Maga village that I have. We meet once a month in circle, and it is as sacred online as it is in person. And ceremonies, you know, I love creating ceremonies, both postpartum and for mother blessings, but also for maidens reclaiming the menarche. You know, I have visions. I really want to go out into schools and teach young girls about their cyclic nature and bleeding. And yeah, I feel like midwitch includes more. So it's a journey of accepting, letting go of the title midwife and embracing midwitch. And not caring that some people hold strong views about what a witch is. For me, a witch means someone who knows about natural healing, about the cycles of nature, about the cycles of woman. And that is me. Thank you for listening to this long, her story, my story. You know, I really do appreciate all you who have reached out. And if you want to leave a comment, if you want to connect, then now you can find me on social media as The Spiritual Midwitch. You'll find me on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube. And I would love to know your thoughts around what I've shared. I love the community that the Natural Birth Podcast has created. Most women who now are taking my sacred birth worker mentorship, I think, come from having listened to the podcast. Such a blessing. And I want to finish this episode by saying that if you feel called to be a sacred birth worker, a sacred birth advocate and space holder for the rite of passage of birth, a woman's rite of passage from maiden to mother, if you want to hold ceremony, ritual, sacred space in one-on-ones, in groups, if you want to educate about physiological birth and about the system that harms women and babies, if you want to protect women and families, if you want to serve at the birth altar, come and join me in the next cohort that starts in January 2024. Come and join me and other women from around the world as we weave the new earth, the new way. I'm so passionate about teaching the new generations of birth workers to be empowered in providing care that no other doula training out there can. It's open for all. It's open for you who've never attended a birth or even had, you know, gone through a birth. It's open for you who are a midwife already, who want to leave the system, or if you still need to be in the system, this can help you be supported by a cohort of other birth workers that are like you and want to serve women. And it's for you who, you know, want a career change, who want to dive on into birth work. It's for you who want to work with it maybe on the side. It's for all of you who are just passionate about birth as a rite of passage. Contact me, you know, look in the links in the bio and find out about more about the mentorship, what it entails. I would love to hear from you. It's time. We all have to decide for a new birthing culture to emerge. We all have to decide to leave the old and start fresh. And I will do everything in my power to see that happen in my lifetime. If you want to join me, there's other projects here in Sweden that I'm involved with that you can reach out to me about. I've started a community for a network of birth workers in Sweden where, you know, we're going to work towards home birthing conferences and birth centers and just a different birth culture. Come and join us if you're here in Sweden. And I'm hoping to be involved in around the world as well as we weave something new together. And we need each other. We as women need to work together. No competition, only sisterhood. We need to come together. Thank you, thank you, thank you for being with me. Reach out. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you for listening. If you love this podcast, then please consider sharing it. Leave a review or make a contribution on our Patreon page. And if you want to connect on social media, then find the podcast on Instagram as The Natural Birth Podcast. Thank you for listening.